Joel Kotkin. I'm the author of The Next 100 Million, American 2050, and I'm a presidential fellow at Chapman University in California.
And you're a futurist?
I guess so, yeah.
How would you describe your role as a futurist?
Well, basically, I would say that what I try to do is I try to look at what are the existing trends and not just extrapolate them, but try to understand them in the context of, you know, history is not a straight line, and that what I think are the sort of major trends and how they will express themselves. And of course, demographics is kind of one of the major underpinnings of that, because that really will tell you, you know, what your population is going to look like. You have a pretty good idea of what the population is going to look like in 40 years, just, you know, given who's here, who's going to have children at a particular age. And so the U.S. trajectory is extremely interesting, and it's interesting particularly because it really is diverting from the trajectory of most advanced industrial countries.
How so?
Well, the United States has considerable population growth, has a higher fertility rate, and of course we do also have a lot of immigration. And I think that's making us a very different country than, let's say, Europe, Japan, Korea, who are going to be aging much more rapidly, and their workforces are going to decline. So not to say that our society is better or theirs is worse, but that we have very different challenges and different opportunities.
It seems like if the American population is going to be younger, moving on, younger and more diverse, that would be a fairly distinct advantage.
It should be an advantage. I mean, I think that societies that are dominated by older people are by their nature not dynamic. They're not going to have the kind of inputs that young people come up with. You know, most great inventions are made by young people, and great scientists that make their most profound discoveries usually at a relatively young age. People write their best novels in their 20s and 30s. So if you have a society which is dominated by people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond, I think that's going to be a recipe for more stagnation. The challenge, on the other hand, is we have to provide jobs and opportunities for that growing population, and that's going to be the great challenge of the next few decades.
How can that challenge be addressed?
Well, I think we have to really focus on jobs. I think, unfortunately, neither political party has really focused on jobs. And on you know, true broad-based economic growth. The Republican Party has been sort of very oriented towards asset inflation and the stock market, and the Democratic Party has been about the expansion of the public sector. And I think neither strategy is a particularly good one in terms of meeting the needs of the generations to come.
I looked at the David Brooks column.
Yes.
Addressing your book, and the title of it is Relax, We'll Be Fine. Is that, you think, the message that could come from your book?
Well, I'm not. I don't necessarily know if relax is the right word, but I think the idea that David brought up, and I think is very much in the book, is that our future is really a much brighter future than many are supposing. I think one of the terrible things we boomers, and being one myself, have done is we've left a kind of a legacy of hopelessness, and, you know, the world was really great when we were kids, but God, you know, next generation, they're not going to have anything. And as a father and a teacher, I can't really endorse that. I don't think it's necessarily true. And that if we believe that we can have a better future, I think we can have a better future. If you don't think that the future is going to be anything other than, you know, a future of, you know, environmental apocalypse and overpopulation and you know, hunger and disease and all the other, you know, sort of apocalyptic visions that are quite popular, you know, you're not going to really do very much for it. I mean, if you look at the origins of the Dark Ages, there was this belief that the world was going to come to an end anyway, and that so why should you make the present any better? And I think the present and the future can be made better, and that you had to lay out a kind of roadmap of that. And that's what the book was about. So it was really what, you know, what I think the book is done is said, look, America's future could be very bright if we do certain things, and that we, in the meaning the boomer generation, the older generation, need to point the younger generation saying, here are things that need to be done. And here are some very positive directions. And one of the things that's very encouraging to me is there are two groups who are relatively optimistic about America. One are the young people, and the other one are immigrants. And I think those are going to be the two groups that are really going to drive our society in the next 20, 30 years.
Is keeping that glimmer of hope that, you know, these apocalyptic problems can be solved, is that going to be the key to this new generation, this next 100 million, solving those problems?
Yeah, I think if people believe that problems can be solved, there's a better chance that they'll solve them. If people feel that the problems are much greater than they are and cannot be solved, they won't even try to solve them. And societies that want to progress are those societies that are able and willing to address the problems in front of them and believe that those problems are soluble. Once you get to a point that problems are no longer soluble, then it's basically a question of, well, I'll live my life and then, you know, to hell with you in the future. And, you know, again, I think that those of us who have children or have students or have nieces or nephews, we have an obligation to point to a better future. And I think the objective analysis would say, particularly through the demographics, that the U.S. has a perfectly good chance of having a much better future than the vast majority of the pundits would predict.
Is instilling that part of the legacy of the baby boomer generation? I ask because I'm not sure how old your children are, but I think there is a growing mindset among the generation following the boomers and the boomers' children that the boom generation dropped the ball on a lot of things.
And you know what? They're right. I mean, basically, the boomers who had many great advantages, although, you know, went through a very rough time in the 70s, which people conveniently forget, I think the boomers did do a lot of things that were detrimental. I mean, we had the opportunity, and the ultimate boomer, you know, Bill Clinton, during his period, we had the budget issue, to some extent, on the way to being solved. We had very strong economic growth, and then we sort of blew it. We unfortunately got involved in two wars that we couldn't afford, and then we didn't want to pay taxes to pay for them. We continued to expand the welfare state beyond the point that we could afford it. And we basically had no incentives for productive growth and lots of incentives for asset inflation. Boomers were able to cash in on that. And now the next generation has to pay for it.
Do you see it as cleaning up a mess?
Oh, yes. We left an enormous mess. Overvalued real estate, overvalued stocks, much too much deindustrialization, regulatory environment that's very hostile to entrepreneurship, and now, you know, maybe in the least short run being worse. So I think there were lots of things that were left that were very, very messy. You know, I always find it interesting that you'll run into environmentalists who say, well, in the future, people can't live in single-family homes because it's too big of an environmental footprint. Meanwhile, they live in a big house. Like, you know, give me a break. I mean, you know, you're telling me that the immigrant or the young person who works hard can't live remotely as well as you did? I think that's pretty hypocritical. I think we have to figure out how we can live something close to an American quality of life and still be environmentally sustainable. And there are certainly ways of doing that. You know, you can drive more fuel-efficient cars. More people can telecommute. We can plant more trees. We can be very wise about our land use and still maintain a quality of life that we would recognize as something that's desirable.
Something else in the David Brooks column that I thought was interesting was the discussion of how people will live, like what sort of urban, exurban, suburban towns, how that will shape up. Could you talk about that for a little bit?
Sure. I mean, the fact of the matter is that despite the desires of some smart growth, new urbanist types, the vast majority of Americans do not want to live in dense urban places. I mean, there's a strong market for it, 15 to 20% at maximum. That would mean about 15 to 20 million new future urbanites. But the majority of people will continue to live in suburbs because that's where they'll be able to afford a decent quality of life. What do the people want? They want privacy. They want space. They're going to continue to want that. I think there will be a movement to in some cases, to smaller cities. This is already happening demographically. In other words, cities such as Louisville are now much more attractive to Americans net, in other words, migrating in, than San Francisco, L.A., Chicago, or New York. Because if you're a young person and you want to live an urban lifestyle, you may be able to do it in a Louisville, but you really can't afford to do it in San Francisco. I mean, you know, the when you have a city where a small apartment's going to cost $700,000-$800,000, there's only a limited number of people who can afford to do that. But if you want to live a urban lifestyle, maybe in a townhouse or in an older single-family house neighborhood, you can still do it in many of these, you know, somewhat smaller cities. So, you know, I'm very optimistic about, you know, the future of cities like Louisville, as the people who want an urban lifestyle choose to go there, and of course, many of them will go to the suburbs as well.
So it seems like there's a lot of compromise between someone who would want a more suburban lifestyle and someone who would want a more urban lifestyle, that there's a lot of people in between.
There are definitely a lot of people. I mean, one of the things is in these debates, sometimes people say, well, it's either going to be everyone's going to live in a high-rise in the city or everyone's going to live in endless, sprawling suburbia. And the questions are really not going to be or, they're going to be and. We're going to be, suburbs are going to change. They're going to become more self-sufficient. People are going to spend more time in them. Most people now don't only live in suburbs, they work and shop in them. And increasingly, they get their cultural sustenance in the suburbs. So there's going to be that. There's also going to be room for revival of cities. I mean, it's 100 million people can do a lot. They can help some of the small communities in central Kentucky come back and begin to have growth. There are cities in Kentucky like Bowling Green that have actually had very nice in-migration from the rest of the country. So I think good environments will do well in general, and they will be of all different kinds.
I have a few questions about kind of the business of being a futurist.
Is it a business?
You tell me on that, but I just wonder, how do you make predictions and put weight behind the predictions, weight of facts and statistics, and make your prediction more plausible?
Well, you know, I prefer to think of myself more as an urban historian than as a futurist, that my predictions of the future are based on the past and past history, and I don't mean just the immediate past. My initial education was in European classics, particularly in Latin. And so I don't necessarily think that a good futurist is somebody who just studies the cutting edge of everything, because sometimes you can get carried away with things that are really quite ephemeral. I think you have to look at long-term historical trends. And also, one of the things I try to do, I teach a class on the history of the future, is I try to look at people who made predictions in the past, and where were they right and where were they wrong? For instance, many people believed and predicted in the United States that family and religion and community would become less important. I think they became more important. I think you can pretty well prove that. Many people have predicted that the population of the country would be concentrated in a few big metro areas. They're in metro areas, but they're in many, many more. So try to understand why those predictions were wrong, and then how do you extrapolate from that? I think it's really more the business of sort of understanding underlying historical processes and also understanding human nature. I mean, one of the big arguments of, well, the suburbs are going to die. People aren't going to live there. They're all going to live in dense urban places. Well, what has been the human nature over the last, 70, 80, 100 years and throughout much American history? The homestead, the suburban house, the backyard. These are not sort of inventions of Madison Avenue. These are responding to the aspirations of people. And that goes, down the road on a lot of different issues. And I think then you have to say, what are the unique characteristics of this particular civilization? Because I do a lot of work globally, but this book was about America. And I think there are a lot of very, very unique things of this civilization. One of the major ones is decentralization and the idea that people are more or less responsible for themselves. There are we have a we oscillate towards periods of that being predominant and that being somewhat less predominant, and I think we're going to start seeing a swing back to not necessarily just sort of unreconstructed individualism, but more sort of community involvement, localism, people wanting to do things on a local level. And I think, frankly, the current administration has made an enormous miscalculation in projecting massive centralization of everything in Washington. And I don't think that's what most Americans want. And frankly, I don't think that that's what a good part of America's progressive tradition was about. I think that I think we need to have more experimentation. You know, Judge Brandeis talked about the laboratories of democracy, that states and localities can try different things. And this idea of one size fits all makes less and less sense in a huge country that's more diverse and where information is available to the smallest town. So you can go to a small town. I'm in Moorhead right now. You can be in a small town in central Kentucky and really have the same database as somebody at HUD has. You know, there are no exclusive repositories of knowledge.
You're talking about things the administration is doing. You're talking about how the different political parties are addressing the problems of the future, variations on the American dream, immigration. All of these are political issues or issues that have become politicized, if they aren't initially political issues. How do you keep politics, partisan politics, out of what you do?
Well, first of all, because I don't participate in it, you know, I really don't, I don't, you know, I mean, I have to say I did support President Clinton and voted for him twice. I thought in a lot of ways our system works best with checks and balances. And I think, you know, when you had a Democratic president who was a good politician and a Republican Congress, I think we actually did reasonably well. But I think that fundamentally I try to keep it out of the politics because I'm, you know, I'm not a very ideological person. I don't have an agenda that says, well, society has to be, you know, totally libertarian or totally corporate or totally government. I really see try to look at what works and what works for people and what gives people the most ability to improve their lives. And you know, sometimes that I can sound very much like a social democrat, and sometimes I can sound very much like a conservative Republican. I think that those categories are kind of silly, and what you end up with in many cases are people who are constantly pushing the extremes, whereas I think most Americans are actually pretty pragmatic and moderate. I think that the extremism that you hear, whether it's, you know, on you know, Fox on one side and MSNBC or another, or MoveOn.org and some of the more extreme Tea Party groups, represents, you know, part of the spectrum, but hardly most of it. And so I think that that's really a negative thing, because, you know, I know sometimes, I mean, people will attack you for, you know, because you don't buy the party line on one thing, therefore you must be on the other side. You know, I just don't participate in that discussion. I mean, I try to look at every issue as rationally as I can and as pragmatically as I can, and to adhere to what I think are basic principles, which I think most Americans would share. You know, constitutional government, the federal system, checks and balances, human rights, the family, freedom of religion. I think those are things that most Americans would embrace. And beyond that, I'm pretty pragmatic.
To revisit a topic you'd mentioned earlier, if the next 100 million or after that, this population change in America, people are younger, what stands to be lost? Because there are a lot of talented people who do their best work while they're young, but then there's also, you know, like an Einstein or a Mark Twain who did a lot of great stuff later in life.
Well, I mean, being 57, I hardly am going to advocate against age. I just think that you need to have the young people there, because the young people make us older people, not saying you, me, it makes us more creative. It's always challenging our assumptions. I think the best society is one, you know, our society, by the way, will be getting older, just won't be getting older as quickly as our competitors. But I think the best society is one in which the generations are in touch with each other and enriching each other. I write a lot about in the Next 100 Million about multi-generational suburbs, you know, communities where, you know, there are older people living close proximity to families, living close to single people. I think this idea that we need to be in, you know, hip, cool, young people ghettos, and then, you know, Sunbelt old people ghettos and suburban family ghettos, I think that that's not a very good way of structuring society. And I think that we are going to see, and we are seeing, more multi-generational households, more multi-generational neighborhoods. And I think that's really good. My mother is going to be 87 years old, and she lives in an apartment in an area surrounded by families with a lot of young people near New York City. And I said, "Mom, how come you don't want to move to Florida?" And she says, "Florida's for old people." You know, I mean, and I think that's a great spirit. And I think the older people could be a huge asset to the society, particularly because, you know, in America, you can work until your 70s. So I think, you know, they have a lot to offer. I think of it like having, you know, we just had a Passover dinner, and I had my kids, and then I had my mother-in-law, who's a survivor from France, and my wife and I. And the interplay between the kids and their stories, and my mother-in-law talking about growing up in Paris in the 1930s, or living hidden as a hidden child in the countryside, or Montreal in the 50s, and then the kids talking about their, you know, growing up in the San Fernando Valley in this era, or my growing up in New York in the 50s and 60s. These are stories and comparisons and sort of things that all meld together in a setting where different generations with very different ideas. And so my kids' ideas, you know, inform my mother-in-law or my mother, and our ideas are affected by the ideas of the kids. I mean, to me, I can't think of anything more dismal, and I've seen this certainly in parts of Europe. A community where there are no children, and there's a bunch of adults, you know, with you know, everything is me, you know. When you have kids, that you lose at least one of those me's, and I think that this is what makes for a vital society, and it's really the underpinning of my optimism about America, is that, you know, because we are having children, because we do value that family experience, that we don't expect that everything will be solved by the state. That's the essence of the greatness of the country. The greatness of the country is not capitalism. The greatness of the country is family and community, and capitalism may be the way we get there, but it is not a religion unto itself.